Mental illness is epidemic in America, and the problem is spreading worldwide. It's time for decisive action, because the battle for the mind is part of a much larger war being waged between good and evil, with you as the prize. Welcome to Simple Solutions with Christian psychiatrist and author Dr. Timothy Jennings. For the next hour, we'll uncover Bible-based weapons for fighting destructive feelings and resolving inner conflicts. Dr. Jennings wants to arm you with the tools necessary for achieving emotional and mental stability as you strengthen your relationship with God. We'll open the phone lines for your questions in just a moment. I'm your Simple Solutions host, Charles Mills.
And welcome to the program. So glad you have tuned in. One of the hallmarks of a healthy mind is an insatiable appetite for knowledge. That's why Dr. Jennings has created his website, www.commonreason.com. Here you can leave your tough questions about whatever is affecting your life, and he'll address them right here on Simple Solutions. Dr. Jennings, here's a post that came in recently, and it is quite complicated, so we'll break it down. A concerned parent has what she calls alphabet kids, and we'll learn what that means in just a moment. These kids are struggling in many ways, and let's look at the son first. She says that he is an absolute handful, and he has high-functioning autism, ADHD, adjustment-reactive disorder, and abnormal brainwave activity in the frontal and temporal lobes. Let's break that down and find out how to help this woman. High-functioning autism, what is that, and how does it manifest itself?
Well, autism is a condition which has impairments of social relationships, where the brain is affected in such a way where kids have a difficult time connecting with people in their environment, understanding social cues, communicating in healthy ways, and they tend to be very internalized in their thought processes and in their social operations. So they tend to be odd, peculiar. They can be violent. They can be disconnected from those around them, and it is a very difficult disorder to treat because of these patterns of functioning in the brain.
Okay, and this guy not only has that, but ADHD. What's going on here?
Well, ADHD by itself is a condition generally of dysfunction of the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex is the part of the brain right behind our forehead where we organize, plan, prioritize, strategize, self-restrain, attend, focus, self-discipline, all these types of things. This part of the brain is the part of the brain that governs or restrains the impulses from the deeper regions of the brain called the limbic system. And so kids with ADHD will have generally difficulty organizing, planning, attending, focusing. They misplace things. They lose things. They're impulsive. They'll do things without planning or thinking ahead. And so they will get things out of order, and parents will constantly say things, well, why didn't you do this before you did that? Never cross their mind because they don't actually anticipate consequences. They can be fidgety. They can be hyperactive, as well as having all this organizational attention problem. Basically, if you want to conceptualize it this way, think about a computer with internet access. The ADHD kids are online for just brief seconds of time. And then they lose their internet connection. So they're in class, they're online, they're downloading some information from the teacher, and boom, they lost their internet connection. And they're off somewhere else thinking about something, looking out the window at a bird flying by, boom, boom, and then boom, they're back online hearing the next few words that the teacher says, boom, then they're offline again looking at something else. And so they're so distractible that they are only attending with these little bursts of information. Now, kids with high IQ and ADHD may not actually present as problems until high school and sometimes college, because a high IQ kids with ADHD would be computers with really wide or high bandwidth internet connection. They can download a lot of information really quick. So they only need to stay online a few seconds and boom, they can get it. Kids with not so high IQ will come to attention earlier because they have to stay online longer to get the same information.
They have dial-up. That's what they're. Yeah, that's exactly what's happening. They have dial-up, like I have here in West Virginia. Okay, well, we're not done yet. Adjustment reactive disorder. What's that, Dr. Jennings?
Well, I think she probably means reactive attachment disorder. that's what I'm assuming she means. It's not quite clear. But reactive attachment disorder is a disorder in which people have a difficult time making normal social bonds or social attachments. I think that is a redundant diagnosis for someone with autism. In fact, I don't think it's likely to make that diagnosis with somebody with autism, because autism is a biological problem in which you can't make healthy attachments or social relationships. Reactive attachment disorder would be a disorder where you don't make these attachments or relationships, but it's usually because of some type of neglect or abandonment or trauma in early childhood that impaired normal bonding that would have occurred without the trauma. So I suspect in this case that somebody's confused and somebody along the way mentioned that as a diagnosis, but it really is the symptoms that are manifesting from autism. So I suspect this kid probably doesn't have reactive attachment disorder, but his social problems are related to the autism. So he probably has autism ADHD.
Okay. And then finally, she says that he has abnormal brain wave activities in the frontal and temporal lobes. I think you covered that, sounds like.
Well, it's difficult to know for sure. That could mean this kid has a seizure disorder. It's possible. Needs to see a neurologist. Seizure disorder and temporal lobe epilepsy, interestingly enough, temporal lobe epilepsy, which is seizures in the temporal lobes, does not manifest with tonic-clonic activity, meaning somebody that falls down and has the physical motor movement of jerking back and forth and losing consciousness. That's what we usually think about when we think of somebody having a seizure. They fall down, bite their tongue, shake all over. That's not what happens with temporal seizures. With temporal seizures, that's not... And the reason for that, the temporal lobes do not control motor movement. The temporal lobes controlled mood and perceptions and things like that. And so temporal lobe seizures can actually present with behavioral manifestations and with sensory manifestations, where people can hear and see things and have bizarre behaviors with temporal seizures. So if there are temporal seizures going on, this could also contribute to his inability to connect, because he may be hearing voices or seeing things that other people aren't hearing or seeing, because the temporal lobes are actually seizing, causing these perceptions to be there. So he's in his own little world, really inside his own head. A depiction of temporal lobe seizures would be the novel Gulliver's Travels. In the novel Gulliver's Travels, if you remember, Gulliver saw Lilliputians, and what was Lilliputians? It was a visual distortion of reality. He also saw other visual distortions along the way, where things appear either larger than they normal are or smaller than they normally are, and all types perceptual changes can occur because of the visual, because of the seizures. Additionally, Gulliver was hypergraphic, meaning he wrote excessively. And typically people with temporal lobe seizures have hypergraphia, where they write a lot as well. Not necessarily sensible writing or organized writing. It could be very disorganized, nonsensical writing, but they're very, very hypergraphic. They just write a lot.
Well, okay, we have a pretty good picture here of this writer's child, the son. She said he's an absolute handful, and I can understand that. High-functioning autism, ADHD, abnormal brain waves, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, here she goes on. He is very difficult to cope with. People just don't understand. I really struggle to cope and often wonder why I bother going to church, as the majority of the time is spent dealing with his behavior. Autism is becoming more and more common, but people in our church are often very insensitive. We've been told to leave more than one church because of our son's behavior. Dr. Dings, we have about 45 seconds before our break. Let's just begin a quick overview of this thing. Do we have a problem in our church, or do we have a problem in our parents with ADHD children?
Well, I think that you can have problems in both places. And problems in the child as well. So I don't think that it's going to necessarily be exclusively one place or the other, and we ought to explore those various possibilities.
Okay, all right. We're going to look at that on our return. You are listening to Simple Solutions, and as always, our phone lines are open. If you'd like to jump in with a question or comment, here is our number, 800-775-4673. That's 800-775-4673. When we come back, let's discover what a parent can do, what a church can do, maybe even what a school teacher can do when faced with this type of child in their midst. 800-775-4673. Stay tuned.
Here's Dr. James Markham with your daily heartbeat.
In this world,
There are many pollutants out there. Some of you might be driving and smell all the fumes out there. You might live in polluted cities, and there might be all sorts of things that you're breathing that God didn't want us to have. One of the best biblical treatments we have is getting good oxygen. Now, one of the things I advise my patients do is practice taking deep breaths. Take a deep breath, friend, and hold it for a few seconds and blow it out. Do that 10 times and you'll start to feel the oxygen level go up in your body. The body is very dependent on oxygen. And as we do this, we can get oxygen to the tissues. We think better. We feel better. We can help counteract some of these bad pollutants out there. So try to do some deep breathing exercises today.
If you'd like more information, go to heartwiseministries.org. That's heartwiseministries.org.
Like to ask you if you enjoy stories.
You do? That's great, because we're here to tell you how you can get some free cassettes with dramatized stories on the life of Jesus.
That's right, David.
You call Life Talk Radio at 800-775-4673 and enroll in the Adventures in the Holy Bible Studies.
And it doesn't matter if you're 9 to 99 or somewhere in between.
They'll send a set of lessons to you with neat activities that will help you study the Bible. Every time you finish 4 studies with your next set, they'll send you a free cassette tape with 2 dramatized stories on it.
That's cool! What's that number again?
800-775-4673.
David and I love listening to these tapes. What's that phone number one more time?
800-775-4673.
Dr. Jennings, I know that we have some pastors and some school teachers and some parents and church members listening very closely to what you're about to say. The question is, when you have a child, and this particular child from this writer to your website has a boy that has high-functioning autism, ADHD, and abnormal brainwave activity, this child is disruptive, okay? When you take this child anywhere, he's going to be disruptive. It's just the way it is with this. If you take him to church, he's going to be disruptive. Take him to school, he's going to be disruptive. How do you as a church handle this? Do the parents not take the kid to church? Do the parents take him and set him in a special room? What's your thought on this, Dr. Jenny? Because the child, you want the child to grow up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. How do you do this?
Well, I think the first thing that has to happen is there has to be a very appropriate and thorough medical evaluation to see if there are any treatable underlying factors that are contributing to this particular presentation. There are various syndromes of childhood, physiological factors, conditions that may be treatable that would markedly reduce the disruption of the child's behavior. For instance, temporal lobe epilepsy that I mentioned, if that in fact is what's going on, treating with anti-epileptic medicines would markedly change the overall day-to-day functioning and presentation and behavior of this child. It would be nearly miraculous, the transformation that would take place. So you'd want to make sure that we're not just trying to discipline away and treat something that has a neurobiologic dysfunction going to it. So we have to start with a very thorough and appropriate neuropsychiatric medical evaluation. Second, ADHD is also very treatable. As we treat the ADHD with the appropriate medications, when appropriate, you can actually have marked transformation as the prefrontal cortex comes online and is able to process and self-govern and self-restrain. That's very clear and well documented in the studies that no behavioral intervention or natural homeopathic remedy actually has significant improvement on genuine ADHD. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes parents get confused because ADHD can look like, or other things can look like ADHD in young kids. And so if a child has some other thing that looks like ADHD and they treat that other thing and they get better, some parents will say, see, we didn't need the ADHD meds. All they needed was to have this change or that change. Well, they didn't really have ADHD then is the thing we need to be clear about. Autism is a very difficult thing because a lot of research is going into it, but there hasn't been any major breakthroughs in really treating or resolving autism. But it is a wide spectrum of illness, meaning there are different levels of severity to this illness. Some new and interesting research has to do with oxytocin, if you've heard of oxytocin. Oxytocin is a neuropeptide made by our hypothalamus in our brain and secreted by our pituitary gland. It does several things throughout the body, particularly most notably in childbirth. It helps the uterus contract and it helps with milk production for breastfeeding. But socially and neurobiologically, oxytocin is a key peptide for social bonding, for connectivity, for relational trust, and so forth. And there are surges of oxytocin that occur during childbirth, and this is one of the reasons why there's such a tight emotional bond between mother and child, because that peaks right at the time of childbirth, and for the next 3 hours after childbirth, there's this huge level of oxytocin in mom's brain. So as she is holding and rocking her child, there will be this very chemical, neurological bond that she's going to have to this child. Oxytocin does other things. It calms your fear centers, the amygdala, where you experience anxiety and fear and apprehension, makes us want to withdraw and be afraid of people. It actually calms that center down and we have less fear. And it instills a sense of trust, regardless of whether the person is trustworthy or not. There's actually a syndrome, which is the opposite of autism, called Williams syndrome. And in Williams syndrome, this is a disorder in which kids are missing 25 genes on chromosome number 7. And because of that, they, in the fear center, the amygdala, don't have overrepresented oxytocin receptors. They have more receptors there than most people do. And these kids have absolutely no social apprehensions at all. They never meet a stranger, literally. They feel completely trustworthy in everybody they meet. They're outgoing, they're open, and they're completely vulnerable to being exploited because they never have an apprehension or a distrust in anyone. Mm-hmm. Which is just the opposite of autism. And so there's a neurobiological relationship here, and there's a lot of research now suggesting that autism is a dysfunction of oxytocin receptors and production in the brain of kids. And this is why they don't connect and they don't trust and they don't bond.
Are these conditions you're talking about something the child is born with, or does it develop down the road? Can it come from an injury? How does it get into that brain like that?
Well, it depends on which one. We're talking three disorders here.
Yeah.
Seizure disorder, you can be born with a seizure disorder. You can have a brain injury or other type of brain injury, have a traumatic injury. You can have a physiological injury such as a stroke in the brain. Any of those types of things can cause seizure disorder. And then there's the seizure disorders. We don't know why there's no injury. There's not, but they still have the seizure disorder. The neurons aren't firing right. So seizure disorder can come at any time. But head injury is a major risk factor for that.
Okay. All right.
When we talk about ADHD, ADHD is primarily considered to be something that's genetically predetermined or pre-risk. In other words, if your parents have ADHD, you're going to be at high risk for it as well. But there are things that can occur in early childhood and in life experience that will, at least cause the ADHD-like picture to occur. We know in normal brain development, the first 7-8 years of life, the brain is very busy remodeling itself based on experience. And theatrical entertainment like TVs and movie watching, even of the G-rated sort, cause the prefrontal cortex not to be activated, and it sits there and doesn't develop the connections it needs. It overdevelops the limbic system where we have moods and impulses. And so lots of television watching has been documented with science now to increase the risk of ADHD. So that's a problem because the brain actually doesn't develop the way it would normally develop because of the stimulation it's getting. We actually change our neural circuitry based on life experience. Also, certain types of drugs of abuse damage the receptors in the brain and the circuits of the brain that process very key neurotransmitters that can cause a ADHD-like picture in the aftermath of doing those types of abuse. So ADHD can be genetically wired, it can be due to childhood experience or exposures to various toxins and also infections and things of various kinds. And preemie babies who don't get the full term development in mama's womb have a higher risk of ADHD than full-term babies. And so there's a lot of factors that go in here.
Okay, so we know that genetics can be present. Doesn't necessarily mean it has to manifest or express itself, but it can be triggered. And you're saying the triggering is the TV watching and the use of drugs can do that as well. Which means, let me get this right, which means there are things we can do to keep the trigger from going off, right?
It's not exactly what I'm saying in this case. With ADHD, if you have there's certain genetics, genetic constellations, yeah. Regardless of your upbringing, you will still have ADHD.
Okay.
So it can actually be.
You're going to get it whether you want it or not. I mean, the things you do, TV watching and drugs, it makes it worse. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that it's a continuum. Okay. You can have it from genes and genes alone. If you have it from the genes and then you do these other things, you'll make it worse. You have healthy genes without it, but then you do these things like drugs of abuse or watch a lot of TV, then you can cause an ADHD-like syndrome you might not have otherwise had. Neural developmental.
Right. Okay.
So the brain won't develop and the circuits won't develop the way they normally would have if you expose yourself to unhealthy things.
Gotcha. Okay, very good. Okay, now autism. Are we born with this?
Autism is an interesting thing, and I would say the majority of experts would probably say that autism is present at birth, and it's very unclear what are the contributing factors. Is this some type of an environmental thing? Is it genetic? Was there an infection that occurred during development? Was there an autoimmune response thing going on? Did something impair the proper neural circuits? There's so many different factors involved in the process of autism, but I think all the experts would agree there is a neurobiologic basis. Something is not right in the neural circuitry of the brain of kids with autism.
Okay, all right. And how about lifestyle issues on autism? What are some of the things we need to watch out for or enhance?
Yeah, I don't think that is clear at this point. I don't think there's any good studies that make that clear. I think other than the obvious stuff like avoiding alcohol and drugs and tobacco and things like that during pregnancy, the things that are obvious toxins that can damage the brain could be an increased risk factor. Kids with fetal alcohol syndrome certainly have neurological impairments and so forth. So we would want to avoid those things. But I don't think anybody's identified a true causal relationship with anything that we can affirmatively do to prevent autism at this point.
Okay. All right, so that gets us back to where we were heading. We've now identified the problems. We've had that physical examination. We have really clearly delineated what the issues are. And we've taken steps to try to minimize the impact on our lives. Now, that child, do you take him to church and sit down in the front row with a kid who is disruptive? Is that what you do with that child?
No.
Is it good for the child? Is it good for the church?
I don't think anybody would advocate going down and sitting on the front row with a child, you know, has behavior problems. That would be presumptuous. It would be setting everybody up for failure and conflict. It'd be setting the church up to have to deal with a lot of frustrations, the pastor and the elders to deal with a lot of frustrations. It'd be setting the parents to deal with a lot of frustrations. It'd be setting the child up to fail rather than to succeed. So to take him to church and put him on the front row would be very foolish, in my opinion, knowing that these problems exist. But that doesn't mean you don't take him to church. You actually want to create, through the wisdom that you have in cooperation with your church and church leadership, an environment for success. And so you would, use a mother's room. Take your child that's disruptive to church and have a mother's room or one of the side rooms where the child can practice and you can discipline and not disrupt the church at the same time, and or use other forms of healthy boundary setting, or if the child, depending on the level of ability and what the appropriate expectations are, and this is why it should be done in consultation with proper educators and physicians who understand what is reasonably expected of a child with the deficits that the child has, because we shouldn't children with autism will not be able to function on the same level in all spheres of life as children without autism, and so it'd be improper to put that same expectation on them. Any more than if a child was paralyzed from the waist down and we took them to church and expect them to walk down the aisle. We wouldn't expect that of them. We need to put proper and healthy and reasonable expectations of them and not put them in positions where they really can't measure up to what we're expecting of them.
All right. Well, when we come back, Dr. Jennings, another question on this same topic. School teachers, should you take a child who has real issues, and because the parents want them to grow up normal and they want them to be surrounded by normal kids, and I'm putting that word normal in quotes, put them in the classroom, let them be disruptive, let everybody learn. Good idea, bad idea? Let's find out when we return, so stay tuned.
Hi, this is Johnny Erickson Tata. And you know, even after giving my heart to Jesus when I was a teenager, I am still amazed at the way God uses each one of us to keep furthering His kingdom. I remember the events that led to my salvation. Who could have imagined that what appeared to be a tragedy for some would turn out to be the ministry Johnny and Friends has become? Well, I sure couldn't have imagined it then, until, that is, I received salvation through Jesus Christ. How about you? Is He your Lord and Savior? God created you for a specific reason. Ask Him for that salvation which you deeply long for. I consider myself truly blessed to be a part of the life-changing work God has called me to do through Johnny and Friends. And if you would like to experience the same peace that I have come to know, would you contact this station or drop me a line? There is someone waiting to pray with you and welcome you into God's family.
The U.S. Postal Service wants to remind everyone this year to protect themselves from becoming victims of identity theft. Your personal information is a gold mine for identity thieves. Identity theft involves acquiring key pieces of someone's personal information, such as a name, address, date of birth, or social security number, in order to impersonate them. Often the identity thief steals mail to get information to apply for credit cards, to order personal checks, or to obtain existing account information. To avoid this crime, the Postal Service offers these tips. Promptly remove incoming mail from your mailbox. Don't deposit outgoing mail from an unsecured mailbox, and don't give out passwords, PIN numbers, or account numbers. Memorize them and don't write them down where they can be found. For more information, log on to www.consumer.gov/NCPW. A message from the U.S. Postal Service.
Jesus said in John 14:27, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give you. Do not let your hearts be troubled and do not be afraid." Do you long for that peace in your life? Let's return to Simple Solutions with Christian psychiatrist and author Dr. Timothy Jennings.
And welcome back to the program. I'm your host, Charles Mills. We're here with Dr. Jennings talking about ADHD, autism. We are answering questions from the website, www.comeandreason.com. You can go there and click on Simple Solutions, and you can leave your message. You can also email them to Dr. Jennings at radio@comeandreason.com, and we'll address them on an upcoming show. We appreciate your involvement in this program because we want to answer the questions that you have on your mind. A lot of questions on minds right now about this subject, autism and ADHD, on the minds of school teachers. And I am an ex-school teacher, so I know it's on my mind. Dr. Jennings, is there validity in your mind and appreciation of this subject that a child who might be, I use the word different, I don't know what other word to say, special, challenge, whatever they want to say, to plunk that child in the middle of a normal, I use the word normal in quotes, normal class, even though that child may be disruptive, is it good for the child to do that? Is it good for the class to do that? I know it isn't great for the teacher to do that. So what's your thoughts on this?
I think that it really depends. It really depends on the child. It depends on the class. It depends on the teacher. It depends on the circumstances, the family. There's so many factors involved. A situation like that could be disaster for everyone. It could be very redemptive for everyone involved. I don't like policies that make cookie-cutter rules that have to apply to all kids in all circumstances, mm-hmm. in all school districts, in all classrooms, and all teachers. I'm like policies that are much more flexible that allow the individual needs. This is what in medicine we always are talking about individualized treatment care, that you don't just take a cookie-cutter approach and every patient gets the same diagnosis and the same treatment. No, you want an individualized assessment of this particular person with their particular presentation, symptom complex, and then individualize a plan to address the needs to this particular patient. Well, the same thing is true in my approach to dealing with kids. And when we make public policy, too often public policy is cookie cutter policy, and cookie cutter policy always cuts people. It will cut people and hurt people. The dough is always getting cut to try to force everybody in a certain shape. And there, and some people will fit in just very nicely and the policies will work beautifully and they will just praise it because it's designed to cut and fit. And, but there's always people who are getting injured by those very rigid policies. And I like flexible policies that allow exceptions to be made. So I can see circumstances where some kids could go into a classroom, in which, there has been maybe some preparation with the kids and the teacher has got special ed training. And there's enough support staff and the family is understanding so that this kid comes in and the other kids can be supporting and accepting rather than what usually happens if there's not preparation that takes place is that any oddball out gets total vilification and becomes the object of mocking and teasing and ridicule and picking on as kids can be very vicious in school. And so we wouldn't want that type of persecution and ridicule to happen to a young person coming through school. It can only make things worse. It also makes things worse for the kids doing the ridiculing because at some point they have to, it only enhances their insecurities, their fears in themselves, that their consciences will convict them because you can't have peace of yourself when you're actually treating someone else with cruelly and unkindly. So it's not good for those kids as well. So it could be a real disaster for everyone. So I think that there has to be some thoughtfulness involved. It could also be very redemptive, though, and I've seen that happen with kids going to circumstances like that, and there are allowances made. There are certain exceptions, certain special rules and parameters put in place for the child with the problems, so you minimize the disruptions to the rest of the class, and the rest of the class is educated that the person at a particular time may need to have a timeout or something, but that's okay.
Okay, that's an excellent answer. Very, very good. 800-775-4673 is our phone number if you have a question or comment on this topic. 800-775-4673. Okay, we probably have some worried parents right now who heard you talk about the watching of the television and the hours and hours spent on this mindless entertainment. They've plunked the kid down in front of the TV as a babysitter. TV is a great way of shutting kids up. I know this to be true. You take the kid, put him in there, and that kid's out of your hair. You send him over there, watch television. But you're saying that that's doing some things to that person's mind. Let's say there's a parent right now who says, hey, Dr. Jennings, I've been doing that for years. My kid is 6, 7, 8 years old, and I have been using that television as babysitter. That kid is there hours and hours each day. How do I get that child away from the screen, and what should I take him to so that this problem will not develop, or at least, let me ask you this question, is it possible to back that problem up in the child at 6, 7 years age.
If the child is 6, 7, or 8 years of age, how do you get the child away from the TV? It's pretty straightforward. You turn the TV off and you don't let the child watch it. The child is not in control of what happens. And parents, I think, and I've seen this so often in society today, that parents have somehow gotten this idea that they are responsible to meeting the wishes of their child. They're not. The children are not in control of their own upbringing at that age anyway. And the parents have to make judgments that are best for the kids, even if the kids don't like it. And so one of the things you do is you say, okay, I've allowed my kid to watch TV as a babysitter for the first 8 years of their life. If I go to take it away, what can I expect? I can expect there to be irritability, there to be protest, there to be crying, there to be whining, there to be griping, there to be all this behavioral acting out in the beginning as a test of my fortitude and as an attempt to get me to back down and give in to their demands. So I expect all that. So what do? I prepare in advance when I take the TV away. You can already prepare other activities for the child to do. And pretty much any other activity that's not mind-numbing activity, games, artwork,
crafts.
That's what I was trying to think of. Crafts, any of this kind of stuff, social interactions, playing with peers, anything, helping with chores around the house, anything at all is going to be good for that brain other than music lessons. I mean, all kinds of stuff can be fun other than, just simply sitting and watching theatrical entertainment. So that is one thing, that the parents just take charge of. Replacing it can be just a wide range. There's really no limitation to it. But in the beginning, there will be a protest. But I can tell you, little kids will respond quickly if the parents involve themselves in the activity. Kids, if the parents involve themselves in the activity, say, hey, why don't you and I go out and play some ball? Hey, why don't you and I go, you know, shoot some hoops? Hey, why don't you and I go for a walk? Hey, why don't we go ride bikes together? Hey, why don't we go play some rook together? Why don't we go? I mean, whatever it is, if the parents involve themselves in it, the kids are much more likely to turn the TV off and participate. And so that's one way to do that. So, and the good news is the brain is pliable. It, throughout our life, it's constantly rewiring the network based on experience and choice. But we want to avoid the high television watching for both the neurological wiring reasons, but also for the content reasons. You know, by adolescence, most, the average American teenager by adolescence will have seen 200,000 acts of violence on TV.
Oh, my.
They will see 200,000 acts of violence. They will watch 15,000 sexual acts a year and see 2,000 beer and wine commercials a year. This is what we're putting in our kids' minds.
Well, it is obvious, and you have talked about this before on this program, that it's time for us to rewire our brains. And that includes all of us. That includes me. That includes our listeners. That includes all of us. This is good news, because with that flexibility of the brain, we can, even as adults, rewire. Does there ever come a time when you can't? When you're 90 years old, can you not rewire your brain? Off the subject a little bit, but just quick curious.
Well, the brain is more pliable and changeable in the first 8 years of life than any other time in life. But throughout our life, the brain continues to make new neurons, and the brain is constantly branching and pruning its net based on beliefs and experience and choice. The reason that people may find themselves less capable at an older time in life is because they have closed the avenues of learning by coming to conclusions which make them feel emotionally secure, and they are not willing to expand their understanding and push themselves beyond the habits and the traditions that they have grown up with. And so when I teach my classes, I tell people, you know, we never want to arrive at the truth. Because if we arrive at the truth, there's no more truth to understand. We want to be growing in the truth. Truth is unfolding. We want whatever we know today, we want to expand upon it, build upon it tomorrow, because God is infinite. We're finite. There's always more to truth to understand and learn that we currently know. So we want to develop a mindset of continual lifelong learning. And as we do that, then it helps keep our mind more elastic and pliable. Also, physical exercise, good healthy living with good nutrition, all these things are things that keep our brain healthy and pliable.
All right. 800-775-4673. I'd be curious to know if there's a listener out there who has learned how to wean a child away from television. What did you do, listener? How'd you do it? What activities, what games worked best for you? We'd like to hear from you right here on the program right now. 800-775-4673. 800-775-4673. Because there may be someone listening right now who says, I want to help my child, but I don't know how. Here's a good way. Let's hear from you. 800-775-4673. Dr. Jennings, this person that wrote in about the autism ADHD also had another child, and oh my goodness, this is a daughter, and this child she describes as a major stress head. This child worries about everything. Dr. Jennings, you haven't talked to this person, you haven't done an examination, but are there any generalities of a child who just is a worry wart and just everything bothers them and makes them upset and full of anxiety? Is there anything going on we should know about?
It's a very wide open possibility. Anxieties can, as I said earlier, and I'm interested in this particular family because we have this kid with autism. We know that that oxytocin is related to autism deficiencies. We know that oxytocin calms the fear centers of the brain, and so oxytocin deficiencies are also associated with anxiety disorders. And so I'm interested if this family has something going on in which oxytocin is somehow not being, so genetic deficiency of some kind of oxytocin in these two kids. The one daughter has a severe anxiety disorder because there's not enough oxytocin that would normally calm the amygdala and help her feel more at peace. And so she ruminates and worries all the time. And where the son has got the same oxytocin deficiency and is having significant autistic symptomology and issues. So I would be concerned about that. If that's the case, It's actually going to be very difficult for this family because there are not really, really yet approved and good oxytocin therapies out there. There is oxytocin nasal sprays, not been well studied. Don't know how much transfers through the mucous membranes and the nasal passages into the brain, because oxytocin, if you take it into your stomach, doesn't get into the brain. It doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier. So it's very difficult to have therapies that might be able to get oxytocin into the brain. So, but I would be suspicious of that in this particular family, given the history you described.
Okay. 800-775-4673 is our phone number, 800-775-4673. I believe we've covered this email pretty good. We have available to you, listener, a way of getting your questions to us. You can email questions to radio@comeandreason.com. We'll be right back, so stay tuned.
Is your life stuck in fast forward? Are you doing more and enjoying less? Do you feel stressed out and tired?
If so, help is here. Speaker, pastor, and author Carl Hafner points the way to relief for the stressed out, worn out, and burned out. With humor and wisdom, Carl Hafner shows in his new book, Soul Matters, that it's possible to live a sane and balanced life in a world gone mad. But there's a catch. You must learn to cheat the lesser gods and clamor for your attention in order to honor the one true God. Find rest for your weary soul. Pick up a copy of Carl Hafner's book, Soul Matters, today. To get a copy, visit www.pacificpress.com or call 1-800-765-6955.
In 1941, the USO was born to honor and comfort the men and women of our armed forces around the world. Men and women who have put our dreams and our futures above their own, who protect and defend the freedoms we hold so dear. And burning in every one of their hearts is a singular, undeniable desire to come home, to return to the ones they love, to realize their dreams, to be free and at peace. And so the USO will carry on to touch their spirits, to comfort them, to remind them, to simply and heartfully thank them for the extraordinary gift they give us all. Wherever and whenever they go, until every brow is soothed and every hand is held, until every song is sung and every battle won, until everyone comes home. To find out more about the USO, visit us at uso.org.
Welcome back to the final 15 minutes of Simple Solutions with Christian psychiatrist and author Dr. Timothy Jennings. I'm Charles Mills, and we're taking your questions today on the program that have been sent in to comeandreason.com, and I invite you, listener, to visit that website. You will find a blog there. I love reading that blog, and also program archives. All of our programs from last year are now posted right there. You can listen to them. You can see the topics and enjoy what Dr. Jennings has to say. There are resources there, including Dr. Jennings' book, Could It Be This Simple? And Dr., I understand that you've now put your DVD series online. Is that right?
It's available now for streaming online, as well as the audios are available for download.
Fantastic, fantastic. And also, if you are a Facebook user, you can go to Facebook and you can search for Come and Reason, and that will take you right where you need to be.
And I want to say hi questions. To all of our fans on Facebook. Special hi to you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a bunch of them on there. So hello to the fans on Facebook. We appreciate you being involved with this ministry. 800-775-4673. Dr. Jennings, we must not leave this topic until I ask you this question. Vaccines cause autism, right?
I'm laughing because there has never been any credible scientific evidence and has been looked at extremely thoroughly, very well done research, and there is no evidence at all linking vaccines with autism. It's mythological at this point, mythological, and it's fear-mongering, and the harm that is being done by people avoiding getting their kids vaccines is quite significant, as various illnesses are on the rise. eyes where the vaccines aren't being given, such as measles and mumps that used to not be a problem for young people. So no credible scientific evidence at all that there's a relationship there.
All right. Very good. Let's move on to another question we have from the site here. This is a listener who says, I'm an individual that has trust issues from the past, which in turn has created a control issue in my current marriage. It also affects my relationship with the Lord, being able to trust Him as well. Currently, my husband has the same issues. How do we get past all of this and to have trust? Obviously, there's more background than this, but this to me is the most important thing in my life right now. Trust, Dr. Jennings, it's pretty hard to rebuild, but easy to knock down. Am I right?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this particular question is more global. This is not the question of, you know what, I've not really had a trust problem until I got married and found my husband cheating on me. Now I can't trust him. How do I trust him again? So that's a very specific trust issue. And you trust a person in that situation very simply. The evidence of trustworthiness over time. That's how we gain trust in individuals. They demonstrate trustworthiness over time, primarily as they demonstrate their capacity to sacrifice self for you and others. We trust the people who demonstrate that they can be trusted. But she's describing something different. She's describing a global incapacity for trust, it sounds to me. Wherever she goes, she has fear of trust. This suggests to me that she has issues of hurt. She has trusted somewhere in the past. That trust has been broken, breached. She's been betrayed. She's experienced severe emotional pain and hurt, and that emotional pain and hurt has never been healed. And therefore, she fears being hurt again, and therefore doesn't trust as a way to avoid being hurt. So how do you resolve this is you get into a proper counselor and therapist, and you resolve whatever it is that is the underlying pain, issue, injury, hurt, trauma that has not been resolved so that you can have inner peace with yourself and then move forward in trust, basing your future trust on the trustworthiness of the persons involved.
Is there any way of knowing? I'm asking a question I think I know the answer to. There's no way of knowing whether a person is actually trustworthy. Or shall I say, do trustworthy people have certain characteristics that non-trustworthy people don't? I mean, talk about subtle here. Subtle characteristics.
Well, no, that's not even.
I'm not gonna trust that person.
I mean, the reality is every human being, other than Christ, is capable of letting us down.
Yeah.
Every human being other than Christ is capable of letting us down. That's not the question. The question is, what was their heart's intent? See, we can be let down by, and you're married, Charles, and I know that as a human, you've made mistakes and let your wife down, and she's made mistakes and let you down. But isn't it true that those mistakes were not from the heart's intent? You were not intending to do harm to your spouse.
No, absolutely not. Right.
So that's how my wife and I are. I trust my wife completely that she will not intentionally do things to harm me. It doesn't mean that she might not make a mistake or I might not make a mistake, but I know that when I make a mistake, I'm already grieving in my heart that I made the mistake, and I reach out to my wife to heal and seek reconciliation for any mistake that I've made. So that is a different issue than people need to recognize that, because a lot of people don't, and they'll say, well, I can't trust people because they always let me down. They always let me down. Well, that's not the issue. The issue is, do you trust them to have your best interest at heart, even though they may not be able to perfectly act out that interest? And then you determine your ability to put confidence or trust in them based on their maturity level, for instance. And there are two types of untrustworthiness. Untrustworthiness A, somebody is evil, they're self-centered, they only care about themselves, they want to exploit others to get their own needs met. We're talking about the criminal, the pet sociopath, the terrorist, somebody who actually, you know, if they get a chance, they'll rape you, steal from you, take your money, whatever, because they have evil in the heart. Well, we can't trust people like that. That's A. We shouldn't trust them. There's a second type, and this is where most betrayals occur, is in trusting the untrustworthy type B. Untrustworthy type B. You have let's say you're the treasurer of your church and you've collected this offerings for the weekend and you have to take it to the bank on Monday morning. You've got $5,000 in cash to take to the bank on Monday morning. And your very loving and loyal 5-year-old child says, Mommy, I'll take the money to the bank. Would you let your 5-year-old take $5,000 to the bank for you? No. Is there any evil in the intent here, in the heart? Is there any evil intent? Is there any desire to do harm? No, but you still don't trust them because of their maturity level. Their heart is in the right place, but their maturity level, their capacity to handle that level of responsibility is not yet developed to where they can be trusted. Now, in relationships, many people marry adults who emotionally are functioning like five-year-olds. And so while they don't intend to do harm, they really want to do good, they haven't developed self-governance and self-discipline and the ability to resist their own impulses and their own desires. And so they will find themselves on moments of impulses doing things like flirting with another person, going out with somebody else. Betrayals happen. And then afterwards, they're remorseful. I'm so sorry. I don't know what I was thinking. I didn't intend to harm you. When I went to that party, I wasn't even thinking about anybody but you. Blah, blah, blah. I had no harm, no desire. All that's true. That's not
this
the problem.
Like a formal, this sounds like a former president, what you're describing here.
All of that's true. But the issue is, can the person be trusted in their maturity level to handle the responsibilities of a committed relationship? And so sometimes we miss that because we look in their eyes and we see the tear in their eyes. We see they know they mean it. They're so sincere. Yes, they might be. Just like your five-year-old sincere. But are they mature? And so there's trustworthiness issues of, is the person we're dealing with trustworthy? Because they have evil in their heart? No, they're not trustworthy. They don't have evil in their heart, but they're not mature. They're still not trustworthy. That's one side of it. And then the other side is, do I have issues in my heart where I've been so burned, so exploited, so hurt, so injured, that regardless of somebody, I meet somebody, even Jesus Christ, who is completely mature, completely trustworthy in every way, gave himself for me, will never let me down, complete self-governance, but I still won't trust him because I'm still afraid because I've been so burned that I don't trust anyone. So we have to look at our own heart. Do I have issues and injuries in my heart that impair my ability to trust? Am I dealing with people who, when I have tried to trust, were either evil people or immature people who didn't deserve to be trusted, and I put my trust in the wrong place and got burned?
So it's possible for a person to be trustworthy in certain areas and not in certain areas.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
I mean,
so
sure.
We look at this person and say, man, he must be trustworthy because look at all that he does, all these trustworthy things. But in that area, he's not trustworthy. And we need to know that.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, this woman has, how do we get past this and have trust? It sounds like you're telling her that she needs to really understand how to construct trust and do it in a realistic, mature way. Is that what I hear you saying?
Well, I think she has personally, this particular person has her own internal issues of hurt and fear of being hurt. And her own fear of being hurt causes her not to trust. And so, therefore, she has to first do some healing of her own heart through God's grace and his methods and principles. A good therapist can be helpful in this process. But as she heals her own heart, then she will have a foundation on which to build healthy trust with trustworthy people.
Very good. Well, Dr. Jennings, we are facing a brand new year. What kind of resolutions should we make this year that'll make it a better year than last? What do you recommend?
I don't recommend resolutions to people.
You don't.
Every person has to come up with their own. I mean, every person's in a different place. You can make those general resolutions, but ultimately every person has to look at their own soul, look at their own heart, their own mind, and make some decisions about which direction they want to go with their life.
Well, I want to give a resolution to everyone, and that is to listen to Simple Solutions each and every week, because we are going to be answering your questions. That's a resolution that's easy for everyone to make. And you can go to the website, www.comeandreason.com, and you can leave your questions for next week's show and the shows that are coming up in the weeks and months ahead. We'd love to hear from you and find out what is on your mind. You can email Dr. Jennings at radio@comeandreason.com. Leave your questions and we will address it. Thank you very much, Dr. Jennings, for being here with us again today and setting us straight in some of these areas that may be confusing many of us. And listener, until next week, this is Charles Mills along with Dr. Timothy Jennings in inviting you to apply the simple solutions God placed in your heart today. Goodbye, everyone.
Simple Solutions is a production of Life Talk Radio and Dr. Timothy Jennings and is made possible by your generous support. For more information, visit www.comeandreason.com.